This passage, pardon me, this passage from the book of Exodus, I've suggested for years, and I've taught scripture at the college, and now I'm doing the liberations theology stuff, is the pivot on which the entire Bible hangs. That is, if you were to take this passage out of the Bible, then none of it would make sense. The rest of it would not make any sense at all. The crucial thing here is, of course, the giving of the divine name. I mean, this is the great revelation of who the Jews thought God was. The name is translated often enough Yahweh, but nobody knows for sure what that means. It's a form of the Hebrew verb to be, but there are multiple translations. It used to be, I am he who comes and brings into being. But this translation, I am who am, has come probably closer to the sense of the thing because it's a name that's no name, you know? And the point of that is that belief was in the ancient world, if you knew the name of God, then you could somehow manage God. You could control God. It's like the Rumpelstiltskin story, you know, bears traces of that same sort of belief. But this God is who this God is and is not subject to human manipulation. But there are also other translations. The great Martin Buber offered these translations. I will be who I will be. Or I will be there when I will be there. Which again reveals yet another aspect of this God, this God's freedom to act, to be present in human life as this God intends to be, and not simply subject to my desires. And that's really important as well. But I think the most important thing about this God of the Jews, this weird God of the Jews, it makes it contradistinguished from every God in every religious system in the ancient world, is this God is the God of the losers. This is not the God of the big battalions. This is the God of the losers, of the oppressed. And that's all that this God is. And that's stunning, it seems to me. Why is this God the God of the losers? Because, well, if you look at the Genesis text where the Jews created this image of the way human life was supposed to be, we were supposed to be able to be naked and unashamed before each other and with each other. And that understanding of human relationships derived from this God who's the God of the oppressed. In other words, wherever we are unable to do that, to stand fearlessly, honestly with each other, and this God is present. But the people for whom that is least possible, of course, are the people who are oppressed. More precisely, the poor, who have no voice, who have no presence, really, in our world. And it takes, it seems to me, an enormous amount of imagination because we have so occluded our vision of this God as a God, the God of the goody closet, you know. Oh, God, won't you buy me a Mercedes-Benz? That wonderful song of Janis Joplin, I think, is a good expression of the way God is preached and the way I think we are told that God is. But that's not right. It's not right. Until I appropriate this God as the God of the oppressed, I'm worshiping something else. I'm involved in idolatry of one sort or another. It is that God, and only that God, was the God of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and this weird Jew, Jesus, who stands exactly in the same place. The God of the oppressed. not with a view to making the oppressed become the oppressors, but to make sure that oppression as such, this misrelationship between us human beings, is radically destroyed. Where there's no possibility of hierarchy, of domination, of oppression, of violence. It's so hard, I think, it is so hard to get our heads around that, I think. It is in a certain sense counterintuitive, and yet I think it resonates with the deepest things that we would like to have in our lives. In other words, to be able precisely to stand fearlessly, naked and unashamed before each other, everybody. So Lent is the time we're supposed to seek the face of God. And this passage is enormously important in that at least it provides a trajectory for that search. So that to the extent that I recognize in the violated and the oppressed in our world, the face of God. That's where we're supposed to be heading. And only there, you see, this is what's so extraordinary about this text. Only there is the real God to be found. So that when all of these invisible poor, all these invisible impressed, which constitutes the major part of the population of the planet, when they become real, God becomes real. You see? You can't have one without the other. I am who I am. I have seen the oppression of my people and have come to do something about it. So we in the church, you know, need to examine, first of all, our own images of who God is, and secondly, the institutional notion of who God is. Yeah? I mean, we've set up so many borders, so many boundaries, so many qualifications, so many conditions for recognizing the reality of God without really coming to this absolutely foundational realization that God is the God of the oppressed. And when I know the oppressed, then I begin to know God.